In 2018, the physicians Simon Talbot and Wendy Dean published a piece in Stat News with the headline, "Physicians Aren't Burning Out, They're Suffering from Moral Injury." And what they argued is that burnout is a mischaracterization of what healthcare workers are experiencing. By placing the onus upon the individual to summon our inner resilience or resourcefulness to feel better, the term burnout seemed to ignore the role of the healthcare system in contributing to our distress. Moral injury, on the other hand, recognizes the many ways our system undermines our ability to care well for patients, causing a kind of psychological distress that no amount of resilience can fix. Talbot and Dean's piece went viral. It struck a chord with physicians and healthcare workers, and I think it struck a chord because it was full of truth. Medicine has become so corporate. Many of us observe our systems prioritize profits over patients, and one of the many consequences is that physicians and other healthcare workers are constantly being asked to do more in less time. But sometimes I worry that if we focus so much on our system's inadequacies, it can be harder to recognize our individual roles in making the system better, whether that means spending a little more time with patients to take a proper history, helping them arrange a follow-up, or just going back at the end of the day to check on them and see how they're doing. The system may make those aspects of doctoring harder, but we all also make choices all day long about how to spend our time. So that's what we're going to talk about today. How do we hold the system accountable without abdicating our own responsibility? How do we distinguish moral injury from medicine just being really hard? And given that trainees so often bear the brunt of the system's inadequacies, what does moral injury mean for them in particular? To get at some of these questions, I'm really excited to talk with A.L. Press today. Press is a sociologist and writer, and in addition to his three books, in July of 2023, he published a piece in the New York Times Magazine called The Moral Crisis of America's Doctors, which also went viral. So I started out by asking A.L. why he thinks the piece struck such a chord.
I think your introduction touched on that, that we have this narrative when we talk about physician distress that gravitates around the term burnout. And the problem with burnout, from what I heard from doctors who have sort of really thought these things through and from folks like Wendy Dean, is that it puts the onus on the individual physician. You know, you're not resilient enough. Do yoga, meditate, you know, take more vacations, create a better life-work balance. And that's a really convenient way to, for systems that may have problems that are causing distress, to put the onus on the individuals and say, you know, it's really your problem. I think moral injury is different because the core idea of moral injury, which I think we should lay out from the beginning, the sort of what it means, is that someone in the course of doing their jobs or doing what they've been asked to do or ordered to do in the case of soldiers in the military, that they witness or do something that goes against their own core values. And if you think about that, you're an individual making a choice to do something that goes against your core value, but that's because you've been ordered to do it or because the system is designed in a way that creates these injuries. And I think that that's what doctors who read my piece, that's why it resonated, that it's not just me, it's not just that I lack resilience, there's something about this system that makes it really hard to care for my patients the way I really want to. And, you know, my article did make the case that it's the corporatization of medicine. It's the fact that the business of medicine increasingly calls the shots more than the clinicians who work in the system. And this is a fundamental conflict that every physician in nearly any field experiences and sees.
So I want to read a paragraph from near the beginning of your piece that I think highlights the two themes that I really want to focus on. One is these moral binds that we seemingly face, and the other is how they are uniquely affecting our trainees. Because again, we're trying to focus this whole series about what the trainees of this generation are facing. And so you write, more and more doctors are coming to believe that the pandemic merely worsened the strain on a healthcare system that was already failing because it prioritizes profits over patient care. They are noticing how the emphasis on the bottom line routinely puts them in moral binds, and young doctors in particular are contemplating how to resist. Some are mulling whether the sacrifices and compromises are even worth it. So before we talk about the trainees specifically, I want to know what those moral binds look like. What did your reporting reveal? What are examples of that?
Before I answer that, I just want to say that I gave a talk in front of hundreds, maybe more than several hundred pathologists a few weeks ago, and I was struck by the generational divide. There were some trainees who came up to me after my talk and said, wow, this really hits home. We've been thinking about this. We talk about it constantly. Whereas some of the older physicians there, it's not that they weren't receptive or interested, but they sort of, you know, have made their way through the system and think about it in a different way. So I do think that younger doctors in particular are facing these dilemmas. And what are those dilemmas? Well, one of the basic ones is that anyone who goes through medical school, unless they're extremely wealthy, is going to come out in debt. And when you come out, 30, 40, 50 years ago, maybe the expectation was, I'll join a private practice, I'll set my own hours, I'll determine how I practice medicine and how I interact with patients. How much time I spend with each patient will be up to me. I think that young doctors training now realize the world has changed. And, you know, the majority of physicians being trained today will work in either, will be employees of either a large hospital system or a corporate entity of some kind. And the hours and the, efficiency ratings and the where their time goes, those things are going to be determined by other people, often by administrators who may go over their heads and say, you know what? You need to be spending less time with each patient. You need to spend more time filling out EMRs. You need to smooth things out so that to make sure that we're getting reimbursement on these things. And all of the attention to those things create these dilemmas. In particular, fields like the one I look at very closely in my article is emergency medicine. You also have practices that are being bought up by private equity firms. And once they buy them up, they squeeze the doctors in all kinds of ways, replacing physicians with physician assistants or other people who are less expensive to hire, pushing doctors to work faster to improve their door-to-patient time. And to hear physicians talk about this, I was really jarred because it's the kind of thing I expected to hear from, people working at Amazon in a warehouse or maybe from Starbucks workers, but not from, these sort of prestigious professionals who have graduated from medical school and are thought to be so autonomous. It was really striking to me. And I think it captures how much the job has changed.
I do want to go back to this idea of what a moral bind looks like, because it is quite different than being a soldier who's killing people and living with the guilt of that for the rest of your life, which is the sort of origin of the concept of moral injury and how it plays into PTSD, than it is to be a physician feeling like we aren't giving the care that we wish we could. And you'd use examples throughout your piece, and maybe you had others that didn't even make it into your pages, but I would love to hear what those moral binds look like in real time. You use this quote from Wendy Dean that I was so struck by, that physicians feel like they're instruments of betrayal, which is a powerful thing to say. And so I'm curious, what does it look like in real time to be an instrument of betrayal?
I'll give you a couple of examples that are in the piece. There's an emergency physician goes by the letter A in the piece. This person did not want to be named. And that, by the way, is relevant, fearing that it would have adverse career repercussions. But A is someone who viewed the emergency room as a sacred space. And one of the things that attracted her to emergency medicine is not just helping and hopefully healing people who need emergency care, but also being by the side of those who aren't going to make it. And this was, you know, an extremely important and gratifying part of the work in her view. And she described the experience of holding the hand of a patient who was dying and just being there for that person because there was no family member who could come. And in her current practice, that's impossible because you have to keep moving. You have to be more efficient. You cannot take those hours to spend. And as she was telling me the story, she choked up because it was so painful to her to think of not being able to do this aspect of the work. There was also, again, the same doctor describing an elderly woman who came to the emergency room, unable to go to the bathroom, unable to care for herself, but whom the doctor was told should be discharged because she did not have the proper the insurance to cover the stay because there wasn't a specific diagnosis that Medicaid would pay for, Medicare, sorry. And so that dilemma of, wait, I'm going to discharge an elderly woman and send her to her home. She cannot get up and go to the bathroom. How can I do that as a doctor? I describe a physician named Keith Coral, an intensive care physician who went through a number of very intense dilemmas. Some of them actually didn't make it into the piece. Maybe I'll share one with you that did not make it into the piece.
Ale described a woman who came in with an injury. She was accompanied by her child.
Keith treated her and tended to her. And as he spoke to her, you know, he asked her, you know, what caused this injury? And she said, oh, I slipped outside on the ice and I fell. It wasn't a particularly icy situation weather-wise, and he developed some doubts about this. And as they got into the evening, it became apparent to him that she was the victim of domestic abuse. And he knew of a shelter and of a number to give to patients who might need a break and a safe place to go, particularly someone with a child, to get some counseling, get some care, and not have to go back to a potentially dangerous situation. And the patient said to him, I can't do that because I can't pay for this care without my partner. And the shock of that, the feeling that, you know, wait a minute, this is medical care in an emergency room for someone who has gone through domestic abuse. How can money be the determinant here for this person's safety, who has a small child, who has her own safety to take care of?
I think, like everyone, I observe the countless ways these financial and social constraints affect our patients. And I also see the ways our corporatization affects trainees and clinicians. The incessant shrinking of rounds so we can get patients discharged, which of course means less teaching, or the ever-increasing volumes, which means seeing more patients in less time, making it impossible to feel like you can do a good job. But I also sometimes wonder how much I allow the narrative about the system's constraints to justify my own inadequacies or obscure my sense of responsibility. I spoke with Eyal right after I finished a week of call on our consult service. It had been busy, as it usually is, and I'd cared for a patient with a primary cardiac problem who every day asked me if I would call her daughter. She really wants to know what's going on, the patient kept saying. And I'm thinking to myself all week, There are so many patients to see. I have to triage. This isn't a priority. And there's a primary team of doctors who can do this. It doesn't have to be me. And then, of course, I blame the system for leaving me with no time. And every day, the patient and I have the same interaction. And I still don't call the daughter. And then finally, Saturday night, I was walking home. And I was like, I have to call the daughter. Nobody's called her. So I finally call. And she's so grateful, so relieved. And it took me literally 5 minutes. And then after, I thought to myself, what's wrong with me? Why couldn't I have just done that sooner? And so I asked Eyal whether there's a risk when we put so much blame on the system that we fail to recognize our own responsibilities.
In my writing generally, because I write a lot about people, I've written a lot about moral injury. I wrote a book called Dirty Work, in which is really about people in various professions who find themselves in morally challenging situations, morally treacherous situations, and they witness or do things that go against their core values. They experience moral injury. And I think in all of those cases, there is a piece of the reader and maybe a piece of anyone who will say, how can you do this? You know, do it differently. Can't. But I personally believe it's very easy to make those judgments when you're on the outside. And that the goal of my writing that book and also this piece is to try to get people to think about being in the shoes of these workers and really facing down these dilemmas. What would you do? It's very easy to say I do the right thing from the outside. But what if there's no clear moral choice? What if every choice seems like a bad one? In terms of the systemic versus the personal, you know, it's not an either or. You can strive to be as caring and as dedicated and as, you know, value driven as you can be and still feel like you're falling short. And I think that that's what I heard from some of the doctors I interviewed. Now, that doesn't mean they're all perfect. I don't think anybody's perfect. But when there are systemic problems, those problems are going to keep happening regardless of the effort, intent, and integrity of the individuals in the system. And I think that's the situation we face here. Again, a story that's not in the piece, but I did quite a bit of reporting as I was doing that New York Times article on a hospital in North Carolina that had been bought by the chain HCA. And I spoke to so many nurses and doctors at that hospital who told me how things had just changed. You know, staffing was gutted. Whole units were removed. And the feel and emphasis of the hospital changed. It had been a community hospital that prided itself on the quality of care given. And now it felt to many of the people there like it was all about money. And when it's all about money, no matter what you do as an individual in that system, you're going to find yourself shortchanging some people. And I heard that over and over again and these were people who sometimes had been working there for decades, you know, nurses who had literally worked at this place for decades. And so there, I think you have a situation where it's very clear, no matter what I do as an individual, these problems are arising. You know, I'm not getting to, I'm overwhelmed by the number of patients I have to treat at the same time. And there's the short staffing is chronic. And so I do think that doctors themselves, have to ask the systemic questions, not just the individual, you know, what can I do?
Yeah, so I agree with you. And I feel like it's funny because I just finished this whole series about training and it's impossible to write about training without, of course, writing about what's wrong with medicine, which also makes me feel like I have to fix what's wrong with medicine. And when I finished, I was like, okay, I want to write something easy that requires me not to think about how to fix medicine because it's so hard. So I would love to hear from you, and you can draw obviously from your reporting, and maybe we can focus on trainees again in this instance, but if we can't fix it as individuals, which I think there's truth to, I think there's a distinction to be made in terms of the individual's role in fixing the system, which I think is very hard, and then the individual's role with the person in front of them and how we make sense of our working lives and how that shapes our behavior. And so I think that's what I was trying to get at. But to go back to this question of our need to be able to recognize how the system is failing, how we can take that recognition to solutions. And I'm sure that was very hard for you in writing the piece as well, because the problems are so baked into our society, right? I mean, the poverty, inequities, capitalism, politics, it's all like all of it's just in a big mushed up ball in terms of how it then shapes our healthcare system. So were you able to come up with tangible ways that you think could make our healthcare system better for doctors and our patients?
Well, you mentioned the trainees, and I want to just touch on just very briefly a dilemma that they described for me. And again, they were anonymous in my piece because of fear of, you know, being seen as troublemakers in their fields. You know, a number of residents I met one evening described working at a hospital in a pretty poor, this served a pretty poor community. And this was during the pandemic. And they would watch VIP patients be given, you know, beds in private rooms, and then people in the community languish on the general floor, who were much sicker and in dire situations, and they could not do anything about it. And they could see in the eyes of these people that they were being seen as the instruments of the system, right? In that sense, they are the instruments of betrayal. How can you be letting this happen? A number of other doctors described that same feeling when a patient would get an exorbitant bill and look at them and say, my God, $7,000 for, you know, a blood transfusion, you know, just some kind of thing that they had asked for, and them wanting to tell the patient, you know, I don't set these fees and I know they're exorbitant, but that's the way this system is. And so in terms of what physicians and residents can do, I think some interesting things are happening. Some residents, those residents I spoke to that evening, were talking about unionizing and collective bargaining to change working conditions and to change the system. And this conversation has even started to percolate among physicians. You know, hey, if we're, you know, a lot of nurses are unionized because that's the way they fight back against, you know, understaffing and, you know, being put in these binds. Maybe we should do the same. Even though we have always thought of ourselves as sort of individuals, maybe we need to think about acting collectively. There's another conversation about our healthcare system that I think physicians have been kind of glaringly absent from for decades, which is, should it even be a business? You know, my wife is half Swiss, and we have found ourselves in Switzerland a couple of times when we needed medical care. And we walked into a hospital and we got care, and no one charged us afterwards. And in fact, when they, you know, sort of found out about, oh, it's America, it's in private insurance, all of this, they gave us this look of like, we don't even want to hear about that. It's such a pain, and there's so much money focus there. Just accept the treatment you got. We gave you the treatment, that's it, you can leave. Should we be changing the system? So that, you know, it is a universal right to have access to healthcare. Whether or not that is, you know, there are other problems with a government-run healthcare system that I know not just doctors, but patients would want to talk about. But there are hybrid systems. Switzerland is actually a hybrid system. France is a hybrid system. You know, there is both a general public system and then a private system. And, you know, life expectancy, WHO rankings of how people do over time and less disparities, it's pretty glaring where America stands on all of that. And I do think that large medical organizations and physicians groups need to weigh in on those questions and maybe start asking the question of whether the system that has served doctors well for many generations no longer does.
So why do you think we've been so glaringly absent? Is it because we have a financial interest in the system continuing as it is? Because I think what you would hear from this younger generation, and maybe this is what will shift the conversation, is that they're graduating with $200,000 of debt. They are getting paid less than, you know, the generation prior. Certainly we're seeing that for those on, you know, primary care providers, pediatricians, family medicine doctors. So is that what has kept us absent from this conversation? Are we all too busy? Like what do you think it is?
I mean, if you you know, go to the sociological literature, you know, Paul Starr's book about how the professionalization of medicine, you know, the AMA fought against proposals to provide universal care and broaden coverage. I do think there was an element of self-interest involved and a suspicion of government that it would just mess things up. My father was an OBGYN, and part of his practice involved performing abortions, the issue of making moral choices and doing the work in a way that lined up with his values, you know, really was central to his career. And I think my father's devotion to his patients was always absolute. He would do anything to care for a patient in need. That said, he's very skeptical about a government-run healthcare system. He came here from Israel, which had a government-run system. And I think he saw some of the problems with that. So I'm not saying there aren't those problems, but I think it's a conversation that needs to be played out. You know, are those problems so bad that we can't take a hard look at the system we have, which, you know, is increasingly not working, not just for so many patients, but for so many caregivers. So, you know, I think that it's an overdue conversation. And I also think that younger people and residents and people entering medicine are much more open to a full-blown critique of the system and to thinking about how to really fundamentally change it.
I truly don't know how to fundamentally change the system, and I hope the rising generation of doctors can figure it out. But no matter how massive and flawed and corporate our systems may be, I still believe that each of us, clinicians and trainees, can play a role, even if it feels so small, in making those systems better. For some, that might mean helping effect large structural change. For others, though, it may simply come down to showing up however you can for the sick and vulnerable person in front of you. I'm Lisa Rosenbaum, and this is Not Otherwise Specified from the New England Journal of Medicine. This is the last episode of this season of NOS, and I was hoping to end there because I didn't think I had anything more to say. But earlier this week, I met with a pre-medical student. I'm going to call her M, and I want to end by sharing some of her words. I had given a lecture about healthcare quality in a class she's taking, and she'd very eloquently and convincingly pushed back on some of the things I said. I always worry in those more unfiltered settings that I'm going to get canceled, and I thought that if I had offended anyone, it was surely M. but I didn't know the students' names. And so when I got an email request to meet, I don't think I fully realized it was her. And I was surprised then to see her face pop up on my screen when we connected. I immediately assumed we were going to have a tense conversation, debating medicine's role in addressing social determinants of health. But that's not what happened. Instead, she asked me, should I go to medical school? And then she told me her story. When she was growing up, her father was often absent, and her mother was chronically ill. When she was in the third grade, her mother had a hysterectomy. When M visited her mother in the hospital, the healthcare workers would close the curtain, separating her from her mother, so they could draw blood or do pelvic exams. M hated that, and remembers thinking if she were a doctor, she could be on the right side of the curtain, and maybe, just maybe, do procedures that hurt her mom a little less. M was completely on track to becoming a doctor, but in the midst of the application process this past year, she had her own health crisis and had to withdraw her applications. It wasn't clear, and it's still not clear, how physically compromised she's going to be from this setback. And so she applied to law school with the hope of bringing legal and policy expertise to the public health work she's committed herself to, while sparing herself some of the physical stressors training in medicine would inevitably introduce. But walking away from medicine hasn't been sitting right with her, so she wanted to know what to do. After all these months of thinking and talking about medical training and knowing that as hard as it is for others, it would be even harder for M, I felt weirdly obligated to try to convince her not to do it. And so I rattled off all the issues we've been talking about this season. Medicine's so corporate now, I told her. So many people are unhappy. The trainees in particular feel exploited, like cogs in a massive corporate wheel. And as they look ahead and see a burned-out workforce, they wonder if all they're sacrificing will ever be worthwhile. And plus, I told her, training is so hard on your body, and it's going to be even harder on yours. And finally, I said, sensing her talent and passion, there are so many ways to make the world better. Whatever you do, you'll still be you, and I'm sure you'll have an impact. But I could see in her face, she wasn't buying it. She'd heard me speak. She knew how much I love the profession. She wanted to hear about people who still found meaning and purpose and joy in medicine. She asked me specifically about what being a doctor was like for those who had found resilience. And when I emailed her after we spoke, asking her for permission to talk about it here, I also asked her what she meant by resilience, since so many people have come to hate that word and its implication that it's the individual's responsibility to compensate for systemic failures. But that's not how M saw resilience. No one escapes life unscathed, M said, yet medicine offers a unique avenue to lessen pain. For physicians too, medicine can heal the existential ache for purpose. My curiosity about resilience in the medical field, she told me, was driven by a desire to discover if there are others who view medicine not just as a job, but as a way to alleviate pain, a vital yet often overlooked service. Resilience, in this context, transcends enduring the rigors of medical training or the demands of the profession. It's about embracing this path knowingly, with the understanding that the challenges we face in medicine are also opportunities to significantly reduce the suffering of others. It made me think back to when I was a kid. My grandfather, who was a rheumatologist, wrote a book about his own experience with illness, which Disney made into the movie The Doctor. After the movie came out, Disney gave my grandparents a framed poster with the movie's tagline, "We place our faith in their skill. We lay our lives in their hands. But sooner or later we realize they are only human, and we hope that they notice we are too." My grandparents hung the poster in the basement where we always entered their home. And every time I read those words, though I knew, even then, that they were just cheesy, dumb advertising, I'd get overcome with emotion. Every single time. At that point, I assumed it was because I was awed by the privilege and responsibility of physicianhood, that people would put their lives in doctors' very human hands. But I also thought some of the intensity of emotion was because being a doctor remained this distant dream for me, something I wanted so badly, but that felt out of reach. The weird thing is, though, I still feel the same, even though there are countless moments when I take being a doctor for granted, when I complain, when I think it sucks, when I don't give patients the time they deserve. Those lines, if I pause and let them sink in, still have the same effect. Those words, however, had never come to mind in the context of advising a trainee. But when M asked me, point blank, whether I felt there was anything missing in my career, they popped into my head. Except in that moment, I wasn't just thinking about carrying the weight of our patients' lives. I was also thinking about hers. And so I looked at her, so utterly unjaded, so clearly hanging on to my every word. What could I do but tell her the truth? And so I said, no, there's nothing missing. And her whole face lit up, like I'd finally given her the answer she was seeking. M is still struggling with her own health challenges, but she wants us to understand the profound impact her own physicians have had on her, even if the results aren't immediately visible. It's probably not surprising, then, that she won't be steered away. It struck me, she told me over email, that medicine, amidst its challenges, is in dire need of more joy and hope. I'm inspired to bring that sense of positivity and light to the field, however modest my contribution might be. Lisa Rosenbaum, and this is Not Otherwise Specified from the New England Journal of Medicine. I'd like to thank our editor, Deborah Molina, our senior producer, Mary Rose Madden, music by Blue Dot Sessions. We also get invaluable feedback from our team, Ginevra Pittman, Julie Barzilay, Sue Ellen Lee, and Abigail Schubach. I'd also really like to thank all of our guests who came on this season, and of course, all of our listeners. Thank you so much.